KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's 9:04.
In the midst of a very difficult period, with the spotlight on policing unlike any in recent decades, they've continued to bring down our crime rate.
Why would someone stop because the camera's on them? Unless you're going to equip guns on the cameras, and then you'll stop them. What are cameras really going to do? You guys are taking away our right to privacy.
My husband is rounding up the money as we speak, and I can tell you from firsthand experience that my husband always gets what he wants.
Well, that was Michelle Rhee, her husband Kevin Johnson, mayor of Sacramento, and they're currently say they're rounding up the money to keep the Kings in Sacramento to prevent them from being Seattle Sonics version 2. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher has taken a couple of weeks of vacation. Supporters of that basketball arena in the Soto area did get some good news on Friday. A King County Superior Court judge dismissed a suit filed by the Longshoremen's Union. The union was charging that the arena go-ahead should not have been given before the environmental impact statement was done. And meanwhile, no matter what Michelle Rhee says, the NBA is not going to make its decision, I believe, till April 18th on whether we're going to have Sonics or Kings. And joining us is the man in charge of Seattle thinking about this and a whole lot more, I think, than basketball, Mike McGinn. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what exactly did the judge rule on Friday?
Well, Before there's the environmental impact rules, the State Environmental Protection Act basically requires jurisdictions to look before they leap, before they take a major action. So in this case, we've entered into a memorandum of understanding with Chris Hansen regarding a new arena, and we're going to do a full environmental review before we approve the final documents and make any final decisions. And the allegation was that our minds were already made up. And what the judge said was, well, you're allowed to keep proceeding to do the work you need to do on something like this while you consider alternatives.
So longshoremen are worried that increased traffic in that area when there are games might impact their business. But if that is the finding of the EIS and if there is shown to be a detrimental impact, then the city is not on the hook to go ahead with the arena.
We can make other choices. We don't have to proceed, of course. But of course, there's also a lot of support for it because there's a lot of positives that the project is bringing. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars of new investment. There'll be union jobs in the new facility, which for those service workers, that means that's year-round employment when you add in football, baseball, basketball in a way that they haven't had since the Sonics left. So there are a lot of positives, too, to be considered. And we're also going to work with the port to address the transportation issues as well. And there's funds in the agreement to do so.
You started laughing when you heard Michelle Rhee talking about how her husband, the mayor of Sacramento, Kevin Johnson, was getting the money together to keep the Kings in Sacramento. I don't know if you're a betting man, but where do you put your money on the NBA decision?
I was still smiling from the prior speaker, which was somebody who makes it to all my town halls, the one who is talking about drones.
And waterfront camera.
Yeah, he shows up at all of my town halls, so his voice was very recognizable to me. You know, Kevin Johnson is he's really a leader among mayors. I don't know if you know this. He's been elected to a leadership position at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. He's very respected. He's a great leader on education issues and has been organizing Democratic mayors and the U.S. Conference of Mayors on that issue for some time. And I've met him a couple of times when he's come to Seattle to talk about education. So he's a great mayor. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is fighting to keep his team. And as I've said before, it was up to mayors, the NBA would be expanding. But it's not up to mayors. And it's always been our job on our side to make sure we are in a position to get an NBA team if one becomes available. And Chris Hansen has gone out into the marketplace and sought one. So, you know, this will just play out. And again, but Mayor Johnson's doing what he's supposed to do.
Amelia Berg writes, and yesterday when I drove to West Seattle, I discovered the Battery Street Tunnel was closed. I have no issue with the closure, but I do take issue with the lack of detour and alternate route signs and directions. Mm-hmm. As I meandered blindly through Soto, all I could think about was what the area would look like on a rainy game day during simultaneous construction of the tunnel and the arena.
So we have construction on the waterfront with the seawall.
Yes.
We have tunnel construction. At some point, hopefully we'll get to a point where we're tearing down the elevated highway and rebuilding the waterfront road. And that's going to take place in stages because you can't do everything at once. We're still working on Mercer. You know, we're now going to go on the other side of Mercer, and there's going to be traffic issues because we're now going, you know, where Mercer intersects Aurora. So Aurora will get narrowed there, too. So, and this is going to be a state of affairs for a number of years. So one of the things, and this is one of the things I announced in the State of the City address, is that we will be working on something our transportation director, Peter Hahn, calls Access Seattle. So this year, we are going to dedicate some funds to seeing what we can do to improve traffic movement through the downtown area, whether it's smart signals, better information,
signs that say where to go.
Signs, real-time information, sharing information. We've done some of that already. We've put up all our traffic cameras. Most of the basketball games are in the evening. You know, they have a 7 o'clock start time. So that is outside of the peak. It's not a stadium with 45 or 65,000 seats. It's a lot fewer people, and it is in a transit-rich area. And I'd say that's the other thing, that if all of this construction drives home, is, no pun intended, is we need transit. There is simply no way, you know, we are going to meet our transportation needs with driving as the primary mode in and out of the city. In fact, it's no longer the primary mode at the peak hour. More people come by transit, walking, and biking than by driving. But in addition to all that construction, by the time all that construction is done, if we continue on the trajectory we're on, we're also going to have added tens of thousands of jobs and residents in our downtown as well. We need rapid transit. We need mass transit. And that's another story, but we are working on that as well in terms of expanding, looking at getting from downtown to Ballard, connecting our two streetcar lines to each other, improving bus service out to Capitol Hill. There's more we can do to make that rapid ride to Ballard and West Seattle work.
I was just going to.
That's the big deal.
We're talking with Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, who it's been a little while since he's been here, so it's got a lot to talk
about. A lot of topics, yeah.
You mentioned rapid ride, and as I understand it, Metro is redoing the timing on that new line that goes from Ballard down through the downtown core. Is that right?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things going on. One is that, you know, it's launched. There are more riders on it. The ridership has gone up, but the experience is not what people would like. It's very crowded. The bus timing can be somewhat erratic. Part of the issue is that the bus runs, it's the same bus from West Seattle through downtown to Ballard.
Wow.
So as it gets caught up in traffic through the course of the day, there are issues. A particular problem spot is getting from downtown through Lower Queen Anne until you reach the dedicated bus lanes on Elliott and 15.
Right.
And we're actually working right now to provide some dedicated transit priority through that rough spot. So we'll keep making incremental adjustments. Of course, every time we do so, there is a debate because it means something else has to give. A travel lane for cars or a parking lane for vehicles. Something has to give when we give buses priority because we're not, we're not going to condemn more land downtown to widen the streets. So this is the trade-off. And it was the trade-off in rapid ride heading out to West Seattle and heading out to Ballard as well. We did get a lot of pushback from people about, please preserve parking spaces for this business, or please preserve traffic lanes for these folks. And as we grow and add more jobs and housing, we are going to have to put more and more of an emphasis on transit. You know, let's not kid ourselves. We can make our roadway system more efficient, and we'll work to do so through signals and real-time information and the like, and better design. But ultimately, if we're going to maintain the city the way we want it to, we've got to get better mass transit.
Okay, so what about gondolas?
The gondola debate is really interesting.
Now, where is this gondola proposed to go?
Well, there are two ideas. The first idea was admittedly somewhat, just pure idea tossed out onto the internet and people could respond. And this was an idea to run a gondola from the waterfront to Seattle Center to South Lake Union to Capitol Hill and build some tall buildings along the way for the gondola to go on. And it's it's a wonderful idea for a lot of reasons, but I'm not sure there's anybody really in a position to advocate for it or make it happen. The other gondola idea, which I would say has more traction to it, is
if a gondola has traction.
If a gondola has traction or legs, you know, has more legs to it, is the folks that put up the Great Wheel on the waterfront have been walking and talking to people saying, we would like to build a gondola from the Great Wheel up to the convention center. And it's pretty much a straight shot up one of our city streets. And then they would have, their idea is that people could park at the convention center and take the gondola down to the waterfront. So that's a real idea because there's potential financing for it from the folks that did the Great Wheel. But of course, there are a lot of issues whenever you try to do anything on a city street.
Well, you mentioned the waterfront, and I hadn't planned to talk about it, but I realized that I haven't heard much about the design. You know, we had a lot of citizen input. We had some proposals. So is
so that... now we get to the interesting part. You know, which is how do you pay for it? And once you start getting to the how do you pay for it, and I've actually asked my departments to examine, you know, how can we look at the designs in order to bring the cost down to something we can pay for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the challenge. So there's no question we're going to do a lot of work on the waterfront to improve connections between our city streets and downtown. That's one big piece. And then the other big piece is along the waterfront itself. So we have funding to rebuild the street, but between the street and the water... and we have funding for the seawall.
Okay.
And we have funding for the street.
Okay, but there's a big swath in the middle there.
Yeah, and we're going to have to figure out how to pay for that. So that's one piece, and we can probably figure that out over time. And then the other thing is how do you connect the city streets and the Pike Place Market to the waterfront as well? And that actually has a substantial price tag as well. So one of our goals now is going to be to look at those designs, those initial designs we got, but now we want to start bringing in some alternative ideas that may achieve the same objectives but at lower cost, because we've got to start matching our program with our resources.
We're talking with Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. He makes regular visits, and he hasn't been here since January. So much to talk about. You mentioned that you did give your State of the City address last week. And as we're talking about money and price tags, my view from looking at what comes out of your office is that the city is in a healthier place than when you took office 4 years ago. So what's your assessment overall?
Well, I'm fiscally conservative, and we had one hell of a budget crisis hit us due to, you know, worst recession since the Great Depression. It was pretty, you know, it was pretty bad. But we managed to finish every year in the black. We've rebuilt our rainy day fund. In fact, at the end of 2014, we expect it to be higher than even in the pre-recession. What we do is we changed our policies, and we take a small slice of revenues and put it into the rainy day fund, as well as any excess at any end of the year balance. We'll put that in too. And so that end of the year balance has helped us when we go into the next year. We did it substantially, you know, we made cuts in services, but nothing jarring, I would say. You know, it was more squeezing here and there, as well as finding efficiencies. So we're in good shape. Now, the legislature's in session. They've got a big budget problem in terms of balancing, and there's always concern that they may do so at our expense and make our budget look worse this year. So we're concerned about that, and we're watching the economy closely because, you know, a slight change in revenues... You know, we have a roughly $950 million budget. Now I've got to double check the exact amount, but roughly general fund budget. You know, even a $5 to $10 million swing in revenues, while small as against that big number, is big in terms of balancing.
Well, we're looking down the borehole at March 1st, which is the federal deadline for their officially the term is sequestration. But when mandated cuts would go into effect, how might those affect the city budget, if at all?
Well, just an observation first. The whole point of sequestration was it was an outcome so undesirable that nobody would ever do it, and they'd find a different path.
That doesn't seem to have happened yet.
It doesn't seem to be working that way, right?
No.
So now we're looking at this. It could mean cuts in a lot of different areas. You know, there's cuts at the state level that affect education. We get community development block grants, which we use to fund shelter for homeless people, as well as some of our economic development activities in distressed areas. So there's a myriad of ways it could affect us. And, you know, let's just hope they stick to their original plan, which is this is too unthinkable to do. Let's find a better compromise.
I know that a lot of the concern has to comes with the Medicaid, with some of the health funding. And Seattle King County Health Department is a combined huge agency, which I assume the city of Seattle depends on federal funding for at least a portion of what we kick in to make that work. So in addition to shelters, are we likely to see any kinds of like home health or any of the neighborhood clinics which serve Seattleites?
Sure. So there's a lot of things that affect that don't come through our budget. They may come through the state budget, but so I mentioned the things I mentioned come straight to our budget. But for example, Washington State could lose approximately $1 million in funds that provide meals for seniors, vaccines for children, child care. Up to 800 children in the state of Washington could lose child care. There's about funding for job search assistance for the unemployed. So there's all sorts of ways that it would filter through the state budget. Head Start would be eliminated for about 1,000 children in the state of Washington. Work-study jobs would be reduced. So there's just a myriad of cuts that would affect us because the money that comes from the federal government, much of it through the state, some of it through the city itself.
There's a lot that you touched on to go back to your State of the City address. And while you're talking about Olympia, I have to go back. Lawmakers right now, they passed through the background check for gun purchase legislation. We had a gun buyback in the city, which I think people would say was mostly sort of overwhelmingly successful in terms of response. And you're planning now another one?
We're looking at a second one, yes. It's entirely dependent upon how much financing we have. We can't use city funds to purchase the guns, and we've had great donors to help us out. So we are looking at a second one. And how long we'll be able to stay open depends upon how many people show up and how much in funds we have from private donors.
I know that one of the, it was kind of, I don't want to say circus, that's the wrong term, but
I think the phrase I used was gun bazaar. So
circus is all right. There was
bazaar is a little less than circus,
okay,
but it was something.
Say bazaar, not bizarre, bazaar. There were so many people trying to turn these guns in that you had all those people wanting to buy the guns before.
I think we're looking at a better site. For example, so we don't have people and also move people through more efficiently so we don't have people lined up waiting to get in. That's one issue we want to deal with. But it did illustrate a real problem, which was the gun sales that occur in private have no background checks.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw that in public that day.
Yes.
Now, we could potentially, and we intend to reduce that those sales in public, but if somebody went into a private room, they could have that same sale, and you have absolutely no idea who's buying, who's selling, where the gun's going. And this is a big deal because this is how, you know, this is part of the market for stolen guns. A lot of the, you know, there's a lot of guns over the years, you know, in Seattle alone, I think since 2005, I'm just rough. I'm not going to get the number perfect, but somewhere in the vicinity of, you know, 2,700 guns have been stolen out of homes since 2005. So I mentioned that too, so people can secure their guns or turn them in if they don't want to have that risk. But once that gun is stolen, we have no way of keeping track where it's going.
Would this legislation that's making its way through the state, through Olympia, address these concerns? Is it enough?
It would address part of it. I mean, what it would do is it would create what we want to do is have a comprehensive set of background checks so that when guns are sold, even in private sales, we know where the gun is going.
Mike McGinn is the mayor of Seattle. We'll continue our conversation on 94.9 KUOW.
43 degrees in Seattle under a cloudy sky. Forecast says cloudy and windy today. Wind gusts up to 40 miles an hour with scattered showers expected and a high of 48.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, committed to improving lives through education, with short-term certificates, associate and transfer degrees, and career training, including international business, engineering, and more. Enrolling now for spring quarter. Information at northseattle.edu.
It's 9:25. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Governor Inslee says at least seven tanks at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation are leaking radioactive material, not just two, as was previously reported. More about that in 40 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scher, our guest, the mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn, who joins us from time to time to talk about the state of the city. And this is an appropriate time since, Mr. Mayor, you gave your state of the city address. Was that your fourth?
My fourth one. Yeah. At the beginning of the year.
You think you've got hold of the nuts and bolts of the job now?
You know, I'm always learning. I've got to say, this is an extraordinary job. And, you know, like I say, there's no mayor's school, but I think I've been in mayor's school the last few years. And there's also a steep learning curve, and I've been climbing it as fast as I can. But I don't think I've stopped either. I think that every day I learn a little bit more about how do you mobilize, how do you organize to change things that need to be changed. And we spoke about some of those things in the state of the city, you know, education, transit, broadband, police reform. You know, none of those things happen easily. They really do take a lot of work and collaboration and time. And I'm as impatient as I ever was, but I hope a little bit smarter about how to move things along.
You mentioned broadband, and one of the things you touched on was expanding broadband into at least two more wide neighborhoods, wide areas of the city, right?
Yeah, so the broadband story is a big deal. We're talking about up to gigabit speeds, and I'm not even sure what a gigabit means. I'm not sure anybody knows what a gigabit
means.
Big, right. And we're going to do that by using our backbone, a fiber optic cable that the city owns that we've strung from neighborhood to neighborhood for city purposes. And the city council gave us approval to lease our excess fiber, dark fiber, to private carriers.
Okay.
We have more fiber than we need. It
really?
Turns out a lot more.
Well, that's good.
That's good. So that really reduces the cost for someone to start providing fiber optic cable to someone's home or business or residence. And big picture, we run our data, our internet, over systems that were designed for either the telephone or the cable company. And we're trying to squeeze it through a system that really wasn't designed for data of that magnitude. And our data needs are just exploding. Our businesses have much bigger data needs, you know, companies like Amazon, F5, people that develop stuff. But also our home use is exploding, you know, just to see stuff. People that work from home want to be able to work with large files, upload and download in a way that they just can't do over our current internet. So we're proposing a network that's built for data and that will be big enough to handle it. And that's what the fiber optic system does. We've entered into an agreement with a company called Gig Squared, and what they're going to do is they will hook into our fiber network, our dark fiber, and they will string fiber along our telephone poles next to houses, and people can sign up for it. And we have 14 demonstration neighborhoods, and we've added two more, Ballard and West Seattle, and they've raised money. Gig Squared has raised money for engineering the system. They're interested in customers. They've had 3,300 people call them up already to interested in business. And if the business model works, we could potentially expand to the whole city.
Because the city owns those dark, are they dark fibers or dark cables?
Dark fiber.
Dark fiber. Sorry, you lost me on the technical term. Does that mean that the city has the power to set a cap on how much the Gig Squared can charge customers?
No, but we are really hopeful that their intention is to be competitive with the private marketplace, you know, with Comcast and CenturyLink on the services they provide. What we can do is require, one, that there's an open architecture of the system, and that's what we've required so far, which means that there can be other internet service providers on the system, so that it doesn't have to – so anyone can use it. Now, they'll have to pay to use it, but – they can do that. We'll charge for the use. This isn't costing the city any money. We'll charge for a fair price for the use of our fiber. But we're not trying to make a profit off it. you know, we're really trying to get the service out there to people. And because we are starting, one of the reasons we're only starting with these 14 demonstration neighborhoods is we want to see how it works with this provider. We are also talking to other potential providers so we can get a little choice and competition in this marketplace. Right now you got two providers and they're working on a system on networks that are just not up to the quality you really need as our economy and the internet continues to evolve. So we're bringing choice in. And we're maintaining the opportunity to have other providers compete for other neighborhoods. And in that way, we'll hope to keep costs down.
Mike McGinn is our guest. He's the mayor of Seattle. And this is a really horrible transition, but we're talking about technology. Earlier this month, you decided that the police drone program was done. You killed the program. That's technology. So
I'm going with you. That was a horrible transition.
It was horrible. you explained it at the time, but again, why did you decide that the program wasn't right for Seattle?
You know, I thought the police department deserved to, you know, make their case as to why it would be valuable in crime fighting. And they had, you know, identified situations, you know, a barricaded suspect, you know, search for something, a crime scene, recording a crime scene, that there would be advantage to this. But the bottom line was that there's a tremendous amount of public distrust over this type of technology in government hands. And I had to respect that ultimately. And I was listening carefully to the public. And, you know, at some point this was not, it was better for us to say, no, you know, we're not going to proceed with this. We have much, much more important things to work on, and it is important that we have that trust with the community moving forward. We got tough issues to work on together. So this was not appropriate for us to continue. And it tapped into a larger sentiment about, you know, just the concern about intrusions into privacy by the government, period. And so I completely understand that mistrust and share it, frankly. And as I listened to the public, I was like, okay, we need to change this. We just need to pull the program.
It seems, though, you're sort of, as mayor, you made that decision. That's your job. But we're also looking at how do you deal with, in Southeast Seattle, Rainier Valley, increased gun violence? How do you help the police do their job?
Absolutely. Let's talk about some examples. You know, for example, so the ownership of the cameras makes a difference to people, right? One of the best crime-fighting tools we have is the camera mounted in the store or outside the store, keeping an eye on the street. That can help us catch a criminal. And very, very valuable. But when it's in government hands, there's a different set of standards that apply. And so we have something like red light cameras. What if a red light camera could help us catch a killer? Because it took a shot of a vehicle fleeing an area. And in fact, there's a bill in Olympia that's raising that question right now. And I have to say, where I'm at, well, I think we should, that would be important for us to look at. So these questions come at us the same we find with the issue of body cams. And we're going to do a body cam pilot in the city of Seattle. But it raises, you know, there are in fact rules against recording somebody's voice without permission. So we have an exception under state law right now for dash cams. We don't have an exception under state law for body cams. So, you know, this combination of what's the value for crime fighting versus the public, the privacy concerns are totally legitimate issues, important issues. We should be vigilant on them, but we also have to be thoughtful and try to get it right.
On the sort of not a 360 flip side, but a little bit of a flip, you're in the midst of you, the city, not you, the mayor, working on the 2020 police reform initiative. So where are we with those recommendations?
We're making a lot of progress on that. So there's a number of different pieces I'd point to. One is crisis intervention training, which is, and this is a training, by the way, that was developed in the city of Seattle, which is when an officer comes upon a situation involving somebody who's in mental distress or has mental health issues. So making sure that we train our officers in that. Our officers have gone through our race and social justice initiative training, the same one that all our departments go through, and including the mayor's office. We've done it. We are have new recruiting strategies to bring officers into the force. So there's a whole host of things we're moving forward on. The agreement we have with the Department of Justice calls for us to develop new policies and submit them for review. We've submitted our first two policies for review, and the department's itching to go, because as soon as those policies are approved or modified, if they need to be modified, we can then incorporate it into training and implementation. So the department across a wide range of areas is working on the parts of 2020. I'm going to mention a couple more. One piece of 2020 is community outreach. And we have been running two things I want to call attention to. One is our Safe Communities work. We've had over 1,000 people in 90 meetings, small and large groups, where they're facilitated meetings. We have members of the community, as well as a police officer, have a dialogue about what does it take to keep their community safer. We intentionally ask it open-ended so that people can raise any issue they want, whether it's, you know, burglaries, whether it's gun violence, or whether it's how they get along with the police department as being the issue. And we've also hired representatives. We call it our Public Outreach Liaison Program, which is we hire people from the various ethnic communities in town to go out and help tee up the meetings. And we'll hold the meetings where people are. So the Safe Communities work has been progressing. And we've also launched our Community Police Commission, which has, you know, police critics, police advocates, police command staff and officers all in the same room. And we're looking to get that one going, too, because we want to be really open with the public about the challenges of policing and work on it with them.
There have been a set of ethical questions that have emerged between the court-appointed police monitor, Merrick Bobb, and the city about expenses that are billed to the taxpayers. Did Merrick Bobb and his staff break city ethics rules or spending rules?
Well, it's pretty established at the state level that you can't spend money on things like alcohol. You know, those are just the rules. So they submitted bills that had those things. Our budget office brought that to the attention of our city attorney and said, hey, these are improper charges. And apparently that led to a little bit of conflict. But, you know, you can't do that.
Can't buy alcohol with public money.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole host of things and that were in those bills. So, you know, hopefully the monitor will back them out and not charge that way.
On a different subject altogether, last Thursday, I believe it was, you attended a groundbreaking for a new mixed-use project on the site of a police precinct parking lot, the East Precinct on Capitol Hill, the Pike Pine Corridor. And a lot of arts advocates, because this is a very mixed-use building, point to this particular development, 12th Avenue Arts, as the ultimate symbol of what people have been agitating for in that neighborhood. In other words, a building that would incorporate affordable housing, retail, and arts space. There are two theaters going in there.
Two small theaters and some office space as well, you know, for potential nonprofits. No, it's a great project, and it's a project that reflects what Capitol Hill values in terms of what's in the project. It's a parking lot for SPD, and it's a fairly sizable parking lot. And so it's kind of a gap in the really nice, pleasing neighborhood that Capitol Hill is, and that in terms of you got old buildings, new buildings, a lot of street activity, and then there's a big parking lot. So we had to break some administrative log jams in order to take care of that. So the new building will also have parking for the police department.
But underground, right?
It's structured, yeah, within the structure, right, as well as everything else. And we had to bring together departments to make it happen. So that was a big deal. And, you know, I need to give credit to our staff. One of the things I've really worked on is having really good interdepartmental collaboration on hard projects like this, not just get into silos. The other one is it's great to have projects that really leverage the private interest. So Chihuly Museum and KEXP at Seattle Center. Again, a lot of moving parts to get that deal done. Sonics Arena is another lot of moving parts. South Lake Union, we want to get that zoning done because when buildings can go higher, we can get more money for affordable housing and improvements to the neighborhood as well as preserve rural lands. So there's things we can do by being smart that leverage public benefits through private activity.
before I jump down to South Lake Union, I just want to stay at the Pike Pine Corridor a second, because this building, also 12th Avenue Arts, is it sort of represents something that 5 years ago, before you took office, a lot of people had come together to work on, which was to create a cultural district and put in place zoning regulations that would reward developers who did include everything from affordable housing to art space. And that could be studio space, performance space, even, I think, housing that artists live, workspace for artists. It was called the Cultural Overlay District Advisory Committee, I think, the CODAC.
CODAC, yes.
CODAC.
Yeah.
Does this building, I know it was done as not as part of that, but does it symbolize perhaps that we're revisiting that proposal to create an official cultural district there?
I think in a lot of ways, I mean, there are actions that have been taken that reflect that already. For example, in this area, there's a Pike Pine overlay for historic buildings, as an example. So there are incentives provided to developers if they preserve historic buildings or preserve portions of historic mm-hmm. buildings in their design. And it's always a challenge because you want to make sure that there's enough of an incentive that they actually take. And the incentive is usually in the form of additional development capacity.
Right.
Sometimes it's in being quicker to get through permits. So you want them to actually take the incentive so that they then will commit to preserving historical structures. I think that we've also hired a person to look at facilities generally and the availability of arts facilities. Capitol Hill's been... It's art industry, so to speak, or arts businesses. It's one of the strongest in the nation. It's been recognized as such.
Right.
Has really driven Capitol Hill's development. But there is the concern that as it becomes more and more popular, artists and artistic endeavors get priced out. So we are working on that in a variety of ways.
I know that the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs has gotten funding and I think is about to advertise a job for a liaison, somebody who will work with cultural groups and with the planning department and maybe with developers. So
that's right. And that's what I was referring to.
That is the job.
Yeah, that is the job. And it's interesting. You can look at policy sometimes and say, well, if we change the policy, everything will be okay. You can also look at implementation. Mm-hmm. Now, you can have great policies, but if people aren't working on them, then that's the difference. So we've been really heavily focused on implementation in a way that reflects neighborhood values as best we can. The challenge is that, as I said before, there's a lot of competing there's a lot of competing demands within a neighborhood for what we should do. And, you know, things like safe walking environment, good transit, parks and open space, public safety are all demands that neighborhoods make, and rightly so. I mean, that's what makes Seattle great. And then when we get new development, there's oftentimes calls upon new development to finance affordable housing, historic preservation, rural land preservation, art space, child care, as well as a quality streetscape, maybe make the sidewalk deeper, provide a walking cut through if it's a large building. There are all sorts of expectations where we hope private development will help pay for some of those public benefits as well. So, and these are all reasonable expectations. The challenge becomes how do you prioritize, because our city budget is limited, as is the, how much you can reasonably expect from private development before it then becomes unprofitable and they won't do it. So that's the challenge we face. And the other challenge in the same vein, and I'm going to say it again, is one of the ways we get more public benefits is we provide a little more development capacity to private development. And then people get upset because they think we're giving away too much. But we might end up hurting ourselves because then we don't get the historic preservation or art space or other things we'd like to see.
Well, so let's talk about South Lake Union for a second, because I know the city council backed away from, if I'm understanding it correctly, from a proposal that would have allowed a significant height increase in portions of South Lake Union, not throughout the neighborhood. So where does that proposal to increase height limits stand at this point?
So, again, I guess that's part of the reason I'm talking about it right now is because there are substantial increases in development capacity in South Lake Union, which is reflective of its transition from a industrial warehouse district. You know, there's still, I think, a little bit of industrial zoning left there.
Yes.
To really an extension of downtown that will modulate in height, decrease in height till it reaches the water. And will also space towers further apart as well. But as you're closer to downtown, there's more height. And out of that height, we will get preservation of rural lands, affordable housing, and street-level amenities as well as part of the trade-off. The question is, there's a few questions. One is how much, how high? Another question is what are the appropriate mix of benefits or what's the right amount? And both of those things are in front of the city council right now. There is a desire for them to get it done because there's a lot of folks ready to go, and they could always develop under the old zoning, which doesn't have all those public benefits. So that's one of the challenges. And then I'll say one more thing, probably the most, you know, it's a big package, but one piece that's been gotten a lot of the focus is a height of buildings right next to South Lake Union Park. And one of the challenges there is you want, generally speaking, commercial is more profitable than residential in terms of how much money you get per square foot. So one of the ways you address that is by giving a higher height if they do residential and a lower height for commercial. Well, I don't think we want office towers right there next to South Lake Union Park. We want residential in order to activate the neighborhood. And that's one of the trade-offs that the council is going to have to look at as well.
More generally, when we talk about land use, you mentioned a few minutes earlier that, you know, you can have great policies, but implementation is sometimes difficult. We have a very confusing permitting code. It sometimes takes a long, long time to get through. And as we add these layers of transfers of development rights and zoning incentives, it seems like
and
we make
overlays,
it even. Yeah, it
yeah.
may. It seems that are we shooting ourselves in the foot by using zoning incentives and variances and things like that to get what we want in terms of overall aesthetics or density?
You know, and we have to remember that jobs and housing are public benefits too, right? And we do have a very serious issue in affordability in the city.
Right.
But we have to, you know, we have to look at that. You know, we have to figure out how to handle that and to what degree is it public funding that'll drive these rather than expecting the private development to fund it all. So that's the trade-off there too. We have worked to make it easier to get things done. When I took office, we had really long delays in permitting, and it was even harder because it was a recession and, you know, DPD was having to let people go because a lot of that is financed by the permit applicants themselves. So we've worked to reduce permit times, and we've passed regulatory changes that have reduced costs. For example, when does something have to go through environmental review? If it's a small project, environmental review doesn't give you anything new. The other one is, and this one's very controversial as well, how much parking do they have to build? And what we know is that in denser urban places like South Lake Union, like Capitol Hill, people don't necessarily want a parking space, won't necessarily own a car, and requiring the building to have a parking space for that'll go unused is just a waste of money. So that becomes controversial as well. But we've tried to figure out how we can not require things that are counterproductive, like too many parking spaces, so we can ask for a little more for things like affordable housing.
And
that's almost a tweet in there.
It is. I'll let you do that. I have to ask you this before you leave because we're at the end.
Sure.
You, and this is such an apt name, you are about to go down to your office and announce a partnership, a limited partnership between the City of Seattle and the U.S. Marine Corps.
Oh, so here's the deal. The week after Seafair is going to be Marine Week in the City of Seattle. And it's very much like Seafair, you know. So Seafair, the Navy comes in and they make their boats available for tours, and you get to see folks in those great white outfits and great uniforms all around. So the Marines have made. I actually met with some of their folks about a month ago. They're looking at holding a Marine Week in Seattle, and they decided about 5 or 6 years ago that they need to go out and start reconnecting with the American people and just going out and showing who they are and what they do. And they've been in a number of other cities. It's been very successful and popular, and we're going to host them here in Seattle. And I think that's a good thing. We have a big our region has a lot of folks between our Air Force bases and naval bases, and we build stuff for the military. I think it's good for us to maybe meet the Marines and get to understand the folks who defend our country a little better.
So that's in August. You can meet the Marines. Mike McGinn is mayor of the city of Seattle and makes regular visits to our studios, which we always appreciate. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
In a minute here, we're going to turn from city politics to state politics. Publicola's Josh Feit joins us for that mere moments from now. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Gifts of stock and other appreciated assets are a great way to support KUOW and receive tax advantages at the same time. For information about how to make a gift of securities, contact Matt Albertson at 206-221-2732 or email majorgifts@kuow.org.
It's cloudy in Seattle this morning, 43 degrees. Forecast says mostly cloudy all day with scattered showers and expected to be windy with gusts up to 40 miles an hour. Today's predicted high is 40. 48, that is.
Support for KUOW comes from Soundview School, a North End preschool through 8th grade International Baccalaureate World School focused on integrating arts and academics. Currently accepting applications for the 2013-2014 academic year. More at soundview.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:51. Polar ice is melting. Borg Auslan knows about this firsthand. He's adventured across both the North and South Poles. He'll tell us what he's seen in 30 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. In for Steve Scher, last week the online news site Publicola broke the story that the executive director of the state Senate Democrats was under investigation for stealing party money. Publicola's Josh Feit joins us with more on that and other news from our state capitol. Hi, Josh.
Hey, good morning.
Why should we care if the head of the Democrats was stealing money?
Well, I guess it's never really a good thing when people involved in politics are accused of stealing money. I think, a couple of things come to mind. It was a really, really tight race for Democrats. They lost control of the Senate. We're talking about the executive director of the Senate Democrats, who is under investigation for allegedly stealing up to $100,000. So when you have senators losing races by 74 votes in Vancouver to hand the control of the Senate over to a Republican-dominated majority coalition caucus, I think voters, and particularly Democrats, ought to be really concerned about that.
One of the Senate leaders is running for mayor of the city of Seattle. How does this affect Ed Murray's chances, do you think?
Hey, that's a great question. And I think, that's something that they're probably concerned about is, who's to blame? Where does the buck stop? And so, after we broke the story on Friday night, the Senate Democrats, there are three co-chairs of the committee of the SDCC. One of them is indeed Ed Murray, who is running for mayor. He's a minority leader of the Senate, Democratic leader. They were basically, along with Senator Sharon Nelson, who's also from Seattle, and Senator David Frocht, also from Seattle. So three co-chairs. And their assessment was, hey, we thought we had a system that worked. Really, we're about campaign strategy and we need to bring in an auditor now, and we realize that our system isn't as tight as we thought, and we're going to turn around and change the system. So I think you're quite right. I think there is some nervousness that some fingers are going to be pointed.
I also wonder how this, as you mentioned earlier, there was a very tight races between the Republicans and the Democrats. So how does a scandal like this affect just business, day-to-day business in the state legislature?
That is a great question. I think, and what I'm hearing is there is some anxiety and nervousness from Democrats who wonder, hey, what's going on? And I think it does. I think when they're involved in this day-to-day struggle with the Republicans and a majority coalition caucus, you don't want these kind of questions lingering and these kind of scandals exploding while you're trying to legislate. So I think this is a real pain in the neck for them.
We're talking with Publicola's Josh Feit. And Josh, today marks the unofficial start of a sort of the second phase of the legislative session. Do you want to just briefly explain what has changed since Friday?
Yeah, I will. Hey, real quick, I want to jump on something that the mayor said previously. We were talking about the mayor's race. Real quick on this, and then I'll be happy to talk about the what's going on in the legislature. You know, you talked about Seafair and Marine Week.
Right.
I just wonder if there's a footnote there. You know, sequestration might create a problem for Seafair and Marine Week. You know, so just wanted to put that out there, something to think about.
We'll have to chase that down. Thanks.
So, yeah, what happened is last week was what was called cutoff day, and so that policy cutoff, and that means that any bill that is a policy-related bill needed to get voted out of a committee in order to still be alive and move forward in the process, that is get to the Rules Committee, get voted to the floor of either chamber, the Senate or House, to still be in play. And then that when I say policy bills, that doesn't mean budgeting bills.
Right.
We're still dealing with all the budget issues. And there's a trick in there, a big asterisk, which is that priority bills for people, so say a gun control bill that didn't make it through, for example, a universal background check bill did not make it out of a Senate committee, the Voting Rights Act that liberals are pushing to help minority voters did not make it out of a Senate committee. Those kind of bills can find a second life. Any bill can find a second life because, you know, legislators are clever and they can attach things to the budget and their bills called necessary to implement the budget, and so nothing is ever dead in Olympia is the rule of thumb.
So we have cutoff, but it's not really cutoff. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, you've got both houses, right? So a number of bills, the ones I just mentioned that died in the Senate, did not die in the House. In fact, they moved forward. And it depends on, and so since you've got the Democratic-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate, both can kind of move their bills forward. I think what you see with policy cutoff is you find out what the priorities are for both sides. And the way this plays out is, you know, at the end, the horse trading that comes down in the last weeks over the budget, you're going to find the other side knows which bills are important to the other side and can use that to sort of get what they want, to give the other side maybe a compromise on what they want.
Well, now I have to ask about the sort of the culture wars aspect of what's happening in Olympia. Rodney Tom, who anointed himself the head of this, you know, big coalition group, not so big, I guess, a few Democrats with the Republicans, said, we're not going to deal with culture wars. We're going to just talk about the nuts and bolts. And meanwhile, we've got like a giant piece coming out of the House that is, as I look at it, reproductive parity, sort of the main issue of culture wars, or a main issue of culture wars. So what, when you look at overall philosophical and policy fights between the Democrats and Republicans, are culture wars still alive and well? Are they a thing of the past? I mean, who's...
Yeah, so there was a big concern going into this. And as you said, Rodney Tom, a sort of renegade Democratic, conservative Democrat, joined with the Republicans to create this majority coalition caucus, which is essentially the Republicans. And he said, hey, he was all about fiscal issues and the budgeting issues and Democrats. And, you know, hey, we're not going to roll anything back. Don't worry. Any sort of social issues. We're not rolling anything back, gay rights or reproductive rights. And, you know, but the question is, was he going to stop things from moving forward? And so you had this real smackdown in the Senate where Democrats were trying to move forward the Reproductive Parity Act, which would make sure that insurers do cover abortions. And, you know, that did not get a hearing. You had a actually conservative Democrat economically, but a social liberal who's often allies with Rodney Tom in the kind of moderate Democrat, Democratic wing, bring up the bill, and he could not get it into a committee. And so the culture wars did continue. What I sort of found interesting, though, about this, and this might be contrarian for some of your Democratic listeners, but the liberal House, actually, when you look at the cutoff, the two big pieces of legislation that came out after last week, one was the Reproductive Parity Act coming out of the House, and the other was from the Senate, was sort of a conservative package of bills that would scale back workers' compensation, which is more of a budgeting issue, more of a fiscal issue, more of a kind of hardcore policy issue, not a culture war issue. And so in some level, the Tom was honest to his word, and these are the two kind of pieces that have come through, which I found ironic.
Well, Josh, it's always interesting to speak with you, and we'll talk with you again soon.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on.
Josh Veit, editor for the online news site Publicola.
The sound of the day.
It makes us want to turn cartwheels, doesn't it? Shauna sent in that sound, and she writes, in a moment of temporary insanity, I bought circus music for my kids. My kids have learned how to set a song on repeat. I hear it over and over as they laugh and play and try to outdo each other with circus tricks in their bedrooms. Depending on my mood, it either makes me feel crazy or very, very happy. Like that circus music. We want to hear the sounds that make you crazy or happy, excited, peaceful. Listen to the world around you as you go about your day. Record the sounds you hear, then send them to us along with the story behind the sound. Circuses are always great, a little bread too. Email weekday at kuow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. We appreciate that and love to get your sounds and your feedback here at KUOW. Coming up on our show, polar exploring, and more.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.